So first things first, today's Wednesday, and it's another snow day out there, and lots of cancellations and so on. So Elizabeth is Hamilton's top public health official. Do you have the power to fix the weather?
Unfortunately, no. No. You know, really important when we're talking about climate change particularly, but no.
It's not part of the portfolio.
No.
Although certainly winter driving, exertion shoveling, slips, I guess this is all part of the public health.
It is. You know, when we're thinking about road and traffic safety and those sorts of things and how to negotiate our sidewalks, our streets safely, all of those things are.
This is The Message, and I'm John Wells. Our producer is Aisha Nasser. And our guest today is Dr. Elizabeth Richardson, who is the Medical Officer of Health for the City of Hamilton. Thanks for being here.
No problem. Great to be here.
We had to cancel previous show because of the weather, and here again today, more weather, but we're both here, so that's great. So, Elizabeth, I can call you Elizabeth?
Absolutely.
Okay. I want to ask you about marijuana legalization and teen vaping and vaccination and some of these hot-button issues, but first, let's talk a little bit about what you do as the Medical Officer of Health for the city. I thought to play around a bit with the title of this episode and name it after this TV show that ran in the 1990s called Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. Did you ever watch that show?
Absolutely. I love that show.
Okay. Do you like the medical shows? My wife is hooked on Chicago Med.
They come and go for me in part. Sometimes it's a little bit too much of what I do or have done, and sometimes it's a nice reminder and looking at the issues.
Right. I found this quote when I was looking up the show. I probably spent way too much time on that in my prep, but it talked about this description of what a medicine woman is in real life. That is, it's one who, quote, sees the past and future and has a passion for healing to restore harmony and balance. And I thought, in a sense, in your role as Medical Officer of Health, overseeing the city's public health services, is taking this really broad look at all issues that impact the community's health now and in the near future kind of thing. Talk a bit about your role in terms of what you do.
Sure, that's great. I appreciate the opportunity to do that because so often people don't understand what public health is. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the great things that came out at Our Future Hamilton was the quote about how public health really does its job best, or when it's doing its job best, it's not seen at all. Mm-hmm. And because we're here, we're talking about prevention, we're talking about promotion of health, and so we only see it sometimes when things go wrong. And so whether that's, you know, responding to an outbreak out in the community or responding to tuberculosis or that sort of thing, or even when we're talking about climate change and some of the actions that need to be taken on climate change, we're addressing it when we haven't done all the prevention and promotion that we need to do. But my mom was actually an OR supervisor. She was an anesthetic nurse back in the days in England. She was a midwife. She was a healthcare administrator. And she's still, right up until the last days of her life, she still didn't quite understand what I did. And so,
Where was that she did that?
She was doing that across in England, as well as in London, Ontario.
Oh, so interesting.
In both places.
Wow.
But thinking about our role in terms of taking care of the community, so like an individual physician or nurses or whoever it may be who's a healthcare professional, often they're taking care of people at that individual level, thinking about what they need to do. And we see increasingly healthcare trying to move more towards health promotion and more prevention work. And I'm thinking about that. Our staff are thinking about it. The 400 and something staff that we have within public health services are thinking about that on the community level. So what is it that the community needs to stay healthy? And so sometimes that's still individual level services. So we do a lot of work with new moms and new babes or young people who are pregnant or thinking about getting pregnant. But we also do a lot of work like inspecting restaurants, safe beaches. We do health promotion work around safe roads, like you were talking about earlier. We talk about drugs and substance use and naloxone kit distribution. So we do a whole range of services that go across a core set of public health functions.
Right. Yeah, and you started in this position in 1998. Is that right?
1998, I became Medical Officer of Health. I was Associate Medical Officer of Health starting in 1995.
Okay. You mentioned your mom, which sort of is a segue into sort of your road traveled a bit. We were talking before the show that prior to this career, you were in pediatrics.
That's right. So I started off, when I was in med school and coming to the end of med school, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. You know, I was attracted to the epidemiology part, so that's all the science and statistics around, you know, how common are things in a given community like this, the who, what, where, when, whys of it. I was attracted to surgery as well, and the analytics of it, and I was attracted to pediatrics. And so I decided ultimately to do a residency at SickKids in Toronto, and I did that for a couple of years. The main piece I liked about that, as I said, was getting kids off to a good start. And I had an experience in the eMERGE department one day when this mom came in. Her little 18-month-old had been bitten by the family dog. And so you go through the usual thing of looking at the wound and making sure it's clean and all the medical pieces, but you also ask them about their immune status because if they had tetanus shots, that kind of thing. And, you know, this was a regular everyday mom, you know, and she said, oh, you know, she'd gotten the kitty in for their 2 and 4 month shots, but really hadn't gotten in for their 6, the 12, the 18 that they should have had. And she looked a little sheepish. And I said, well, is the family dog immunized? Because you have to ask that too, whether the dog's had its rabies shot. And she said, oh, yes, the dog was fully immunized. Right. And so I asked her, I said, I'm not meaning to judge in any way, but help me understand why the dog's fully immunized, but you have a hard time with the kids. Like, how is it we're getting in the way from helping you with that?
Right.
And she said, you know, the system really is set up well for her dog. They have after hours. They have reminders about what is needed. They have all those things. She said, I don't get any of that from the health system side.
Interesting.
And as I sat back and looked at it, it was like, you know, I can make a difference one kitty at a time, one family at a time, or I can start to look at those systemic issues in terms of how do we get a whole community off to a good start? How do we get every kid off to a good start? And so start to make that transition over to public health.
It just occurred to me now, I was at that summit, the Our Future Hamilton Summit. You made reference to the metaphor of the upstream thinking, right, in terms of prevention, which, whether that's getting vaccinations and that sort of thing. I mentioned the late 90s when you became head of public health. That back then it occurs to me that, you know, a big piece of public health is informing people about how to live safe and healthy lives. And today there's so much information, health information at the public's fingertips online that didn't exist when you were starting or when I was starting in journalism. And that can be good and that can be a helpful thing and perhaps not as well. So to take one example as my segue into vaccinations, you know, that there's so much posted online by those who've been labeled anti-vaxxers about the alleged dangers of vaccination and so on. In a general sense, does the access to online information, is that a concern for you? And then more specifically about the vaccinations, how do you feel about that and the information that's out there and that a lot of people have a lot of choices to make about what they want to believe?
Absolutely. And, you know, access to information is a good thing. That's the bottom line, is that, you know, having information out there. I remember the days where we had to pour over these reference texts to find out where the articles might be from any given year and then go search out the actual article in the library. Right. In, like, stacks and stacks of books. Like, that's how hard it was to get a piece of information.
You had to be strong and carry this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. They're big books that you carry around. And you had to hope that the last person put them back, right?
Exactly.
So now we have much quicker access to information, and we've, in fact, got information overload at this point. And trying to sort out the best quality of information is the challenge we have today. So no matter what, when it comes with dealing with information, we're going to have something that helps us to get to it and decide what's the best quality of information. That's always been there. And I think that's a bit more of a challenge today than it perhaps was in the past, in that there's lots of ways, lots of different things that are out there online. And so it is important that people look at what is the best source of information, where can I get those sources of information. And there's a bit of a challenge between you know, scientifically based information, and the scientific test is a fairly high bar in terms of what trying to prove. And scientists tend to be fairly self-reflective and, you know, and talking about what we know today, because information changes over time as well. So they always want to leave some room for where it's going to go, which can make us sound uncertain.
Right.
And as information evolves, it can make it look like, oh, you know, you messed up about that. But that is the reality of information as well, is that it does change over time. As we discover new things, you know, get new understandings of things than we would have had before. So that's part of the challenge. When it comes to vaccinations, you know, there's been some really significant things that have happened. You know, we know if you look back at particularly Britain back in, you know, the 80s and 90s, when there was a lot of concern about pertussis, and there was then a lot of concern about measles vaccine, and we saw drops in immunization rates there, significant drops that happened. But then we also saw some really significant outbreaks happen. And so, you know, when we're talking about whooping cough or pertussis, you know, we saw little babies dying because they weren't vaccinated, their families around them weren't vaccinated, the kiddies around them. You know, the same thing happened with measles, and we had that very famous case where the studies were actually debunked around autism and measles. And so it is really critical that people are looking at where are the best sources of information, where can they get them from, and keeping up to date on those.
Mm-hmm. In this age, the digital age, and more so all the time, it seems their trust is something that's, it seems like a fluid thing. People increasingly don't trust voices of authority from across the spectrum, right? People are picking and choosing, I guess, who they want to believe, and that, I mean, I guess that's got to be difficult for someone in your position doing public health education.
Absolutely. You know, we've always known that the currency of that we have is trust, that people need to be able to trust the information we have, build trusting relationships, whether it's at the individual level or the community level. But no time more so than now, that piece about trust and the general sort of feeling of lack of trust or suspicion about government, about, you know, big whatever it may be, is out there. And so it becomes harder to win that trust.
Right. And just to be clear, you encourage vaccination across the board.
Absolutely encourage vaccination across the board.
Right. In Hamilton in general, I mean, I don't know if you keep statistics on this kind of thing or have a sense of this, but in general, are vaccinations being done at an adequate rate kind of thing, or what would you say?
So we do keep really detailed track of this up to the end of high school. And so for every child that is in elementary school, secondary school, and daycares, we collect their immunization data around a particular subset of vaccines under what's called the Immunization of School Pupils Act. So looking at things like measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis. And you know, people sometimes think, well, those are old diseases, right? But they do reemerge from other parts of the world when we're talking about measles and those sorts of things. So it is important to keep up to date on those. When we look at all that information, people are required to be immunized, or kids are required to be immunized while they're in school. And if they're not, if they choose not to, they may not be for medical reasons. So if they have some severe medical condition that gets in the way, or if they don't feel that immunization is right for them, there is that ability, what we call a statement of conscience, that they don't feel that this is the right thing for their child or for themselves to do. Those are permitted. And that the rate at which that happens is held steady at about 2 to 2.5%. We have about 95% of kids vaccinated. Sometimes we know that we're getting the kids vaccinated through the review process we do and sending out notices, particularly for adolescents, the 14 to 16-year-old booster for tetanus and whatnot that they're supposed to get. That's a little bit more challenging. But by and large, people are vaccinated well. The other vaccines that are more voluntary that are included, hepatitis B, HPV, those ones are ones where we do tend to see slightly lower rates in the high 60s, low 70s in terms of those, and so we'd love to see those rates go up as well.
Right. The flu shot, I guess, is that considered a vaccination as well, or is that another different category?
Absolutely, it's a vaccination, same sort of idea. Right. Overall, in across Canada, really, and Hamilton's no different, we sit at about 32% of people vaccinated.
Really?
But it really varies by age. Yeah. And so when you look at the age group that's over 65, that's more like 65%,
right,
which is exactly what we would want to see, is that, you know, those who have a chronic disease or who are over the age of 65 are vaccinated. And then it is lower amongst other age groups, despite universal flu vaccination.
I've heard anecdotally that oftentimes health professionals, physicians, don't get the flu shot. And nurses, I'm not sure if I've read that or, but anyway, any theory on why, why that is? You talk about trust, that erodes it for some people. Well, if my doctor's not getting it, I'm not getting it.
Well, we all know the story about the shoemaker who had no shoes, whose children had no shoes, right? And so I think, you know, sometimes absolutely that does come, you know, people look at that and worry about that. And we did see that when we went through and we're trying to get flu rates up, because immunization of people around people who are at risk is so critical. So whether you're talking about measles and a child who can't be vaccinated with a live vaccine because they have some underlying problem, or whether you're talking about seniors with flu or people with chronic conditions who are at risk for flu but they may not be able to be vaccinated or may still be susceptible, as the case is with the flu vaccine, it's not 100% effective, then you really want that to be, that protection to be there for all. And so we've worked hard at working with healthcare providers. I think the whole piece about mandatory always puts people into that sort of, do I need to do this, and thinking about it. But it is also the reality of healthcare that sometimes we forget about ourselves. You know, we know that's a particular phenomenon in terms of burnout and all those sorts of things that happens, and we forget to take care of ourselves the way that we're advising our patients to.
Right. I guess, you know, physicians, nurses, health professionals are human, and they will smoke and they will do things that are unhealthy, even if they're in that job, like the shoemaker, as you mentioned. Jumping to another hot issue that's been in the media, and certainly locally with stores set to open up, legalization, marijuana legalization. From a public health perspective, first of all, do you support legalization in principle or not?
Absolutely. You know, and there's a great graph that I wish we had and could show, but it's essentially looks at things like cannabis legalization, other drugs, but it applies in other areas as well. And if you look at it, really strict controls that are put in place, like criminalization, you tend to have more harms. And if you have really liberal, like free access, you tend to have more harms. And the sweet spot is in that middle place where you can have controls on it. You can make sure that there's quality controls. You can make sure there's access controls. You can make sure you can talk about it. You know, there's no stigma about talking about drug use. You can do research on it to understand it and what causes health effects and harms and all those sorts of things. That's really the best place to be. There's this kind of U-shaped curve, and you have less harms when you're in that vein. So we know from cannabis, the way it was treated in the past, that there was a significant amount of harm that was created through using the criminal justice system to do it. Not that anybody intended those harms, and that's what we talked a bit about at our future Hamilton, is these are some of the unintended consequences of what seemed like good policy decisions. But when we look at it and what's happening, we were seeing significant harm from criminalization. And so the move to legalization, the goal is to end up reducing those harms. And so we talk about, when we're talking about working with cannabis, a four-pillar approach where we're looking at prevention. And we can get into this some more if you like, but we talk about treatment of substance use disorder. We talk about reducing the harms. And we talk about justice or social justice associated with it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a focus in all those areas to try to reduce those harms without having people think it's safe and it should just be a complete free-for-all when it comes to cannabis.
Right. Well, and that, like, and your last point, and then with respect to prevention, I guess, so, you know, in terms of youth, for example, is there a concern, I guess this gets at the prevention piece probably, but that marijuana being legalized, that it becomes an easier option for younger people if there's that sense of acceptability of it as a substance that's okay to experiment with and that sort of thing.
And that's, you know, youth are a particular concern for us for two reasons. One is this whole idea of normalization. So we went through this with tobacco, and youth were a particular strong part of denormalizing, as we call it, tobacco use, right? So they worked hard with their parents to get them to stop smoking.
Right.
And they were a significant force in making that actually happen. And so that piece about normalizing it is a concern to us. When you look at it, about 30% of kids in schools have used cannabis in the last year, but 70 to 80% of kids haven't. So the normal is not the use. The normal is the non-use.
Right.
And so we need to continue to remember those things and remind people about those things. The other piece with youth is that kids' brains continue to develop until they're 25. So we have this kind of arbitrary notion that when you're done school, you're grown up, or you know, you're 16 or you're 18, but your brain's still working away, figuring out how to make the best connections right the way through. And so cannabis and alcohol as well can be particularly damaging during that sort of phase of growth and as the brain is finally shaped. And so we really want people to delay that first use until after the age of 25.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about vaping? I have a teenage daughter, and she can't stand the vaping. But all her friends, her friends do it. And the sense I get from what I hear is that teenagers, I have no idea what the numbers are of this, but it seems like that, you know, many of them certainly believe that vaping is a cool and harmless activity. That it's a lot cooler than smoking tobacco, which has sort of fallen into disfavor. So how big of a concern for you is vaping?
So vaping is a significant concern. You know, I have a teenage son as well, and I've certainly seen the kids go through that sort of stage in their development.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the things to remember, is it is a stage. For kids, teens are going to go through that stage where they're testing things with their parents and with the system and schools, wherever it may be, and they're trying to figure out, they kind of feel immortal, and you know, what works, what doesn't. They're rebelling to one extent or another. And so as they go through that process, again, what we're trying to do is give them good information, set some limits around things, and as they go through that process, keep them as safe as we can.
Right.
But, you know, vaping, when it comes to kids, absolutely we've seen the rates rise with that. In fact, it's higher than levels of tobacco use, because they don't.
It is.
They understand the harms of tobacco.
Yeah.
We've been running a smoke is smoke campaign that no matter where your smoke is coming from, smoke's not a good thing for your lungs. Right, right. Smoke's not a good thing for your body.
Yeah.
And so this isn't like feeding your body in any way, shape, or form. And this is part of the piece too about saying there's a big difference between safe and, you know, legal or things like that. So when it comes to vaping, you know, we are concerned. Do want to talk to teens more about that. There is some science that shows that if they're vaping, then they can go on to take up tobacco. You know, for somebody who's already smoking, it's being considered as a way to reduce smoking or
right.
move to a less harmful way of smoking. But that's coming down from a greater harm. That's not what we want to see going mm-hmm. in the other direction. So
right.
definitely a piece that we're focusing on around all this.
And I guess with vaping, and I've not looked into this in much detail at all, but I guess there's different types of it, and so the different levels of nicotine and so on. Well, I guess that makes it difficult too, because I could see a younger person or anyone saying, "Well, no, this isn't the harmful kind. This is the good kind," or something like that.
And the kind of stuff that the marketing that goes into it as well. And so we saw this around tobacco when it came to flavored tobacco. And so, you know, legislation was amended to not allow for flavored tobacco. We see this with flavored alcohol that's targeted towards more teen targeted sort of, you know, drinks and flavors and whatnot. You
right.
see it with cannabis as well, and you see it with vaping. And so, you know, that's an important part of consideration with legislation as it goes forward on what's being looked at is what do you do to minimize those sorts of things?
Mm-hmm.
And so vaping's another area where we're going to go through those considerations.
It's interesting. You know, you mentioned alcohol. It's like I could see. I mean, the alcohol industry is, you know, it gets an easier ride of it, I suppose. I mean, I know there are younger people who talk about that. You know, that alcohol is considered socially acceptable, whereas cannabis, I guess, now moving more perhaps into that area with legalization, but then in vaping as well, that are sort of. More black sheep activities, whereas the drinking, having a cooler, and these things, alcohol's managed to, like maybe because of its longevity, achieve the status of not being as bad for you, you know. But
and nothing could be further from the truth.
Yep,
ultimately,
right.
You know, when we look at, and part of it is we do have really good science to do these calculations. But when you look at tobacco again, you would see that the harms from alcohol for our community, and you see this across Canada and elsewhere. It's alcohol that's the most harmful drug that we have out there by far.
In terms of the impact it's having.
In terms of the impact, yeah. When you think about liver disease, you think about impacts on accidents and car crashes, all of those sorts of things, that it by far is still the number one impacts on both the person who's using it and the people around them. Cannabis is not as great, doesn't have as great a harms in terms of what we're seeing today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what will happen as things shift, that will be part of the question as well. You know, if use patterns shift, will there be more harms that we see with it? And so that's part of our job too within public health, is to monitor those things, feed that information back so that good decisions can be made.
Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to get into this field? What is it about public health that does it for you as a career?
So there's two sort of things. The first piece is that piece about trying to move upstream, and so
mm-hmm.
promoting health, preventing disease, rather than treating it after it's happened. And so
right.
for me, that happens both in any particular issue that we're looking at, so vaccinations when it comes to infectious diseases, but also from a life course perspective. You know, we know that if we make investments in early childhood education, for example, we get 9 times the payback than if you make investments later on, even as late as the teen years. And so that's, you know, a big part of it. For me, it's also the ability to impact at a broader level. So as an individual physician, most often you're just treating one person or perhaps a family together. But within public health, we work at all those different levels, both at the individual level and treatment or harm reduction approaches. We work at the group level, whether it's talking to kids about cannabis and that kind of thing. We work at the policy level too, in terms of things like our own local tobacco control bylaw, but influencing policy at the provincial and national level as well. So there's that potential for an even greater impact.
I want to close off by touching on what I was thinking is perhaps the biggest issue of all with public health, and that's access. I think access is at the heart of what the Spectator's Code Red work has been all about. That's in the paper this week with the anniversary of the first Code Red project. That I think is sort of getting at the root of poor health is often simply access to services. We're getting back to that information piece. Knowing what's out there that can help you in the first place. And there are barriers, it seems to me, to access. So How do you feel about that in terms of the access piece and the barriers and just how big of a nut this is to crack in Hamilton?
So I'm really glad you asked that question. I think, you know, the issues that Code Red has raised, you know, a decade ago and now a decade later have been really important ones. And in fact, they've sparked conversations across the country. You know, I've gone to meetings, you know, with my partners, the other public health officers from across the country, and they're like, so tell us about Code Red.
Wow.
And what's been happening there in Hamilton. And you know, the underlying piece I think it really raised was the difference in health depending on where you lived. And that really comes back to the determinants of health. And so when we talk about access, I wouldn't talk just about the access to healthcare services, but talk about access to health. And when we think about what determines how healthy you are or how sick you are, 50% of what determines that health is in the social determinants. So when you're thinking about 50% or more, talking about income, employment, gender, race, all of those sorts of issues and how we as a society work those issues through and have access to health through those things, to jobs, to employment, to income, to good early childhood education and child care. Another 25% of it comes from healthcare services. And then we look at our own human biology and genetics and that sort of thing, and then the environment. So when we're talking about access to health, we need to think about it way more broadly than just the services. In fact, I think Steve, you know, brought up that the number of family physicians has actually increased, but we still have high rates of utilization in emerge departments, whether it's for heart problems or whatever it's for. And so, you know, he's really provoking us to think about how can we actually improve people's health through other mechanisms than just healthcare. I think there is a big piece, and we've seen that with the introduction of the legislation yesterday on Tuesday around integrated healthcare. We can do a better job of getting, you know, care coordinated around people and access in that way. And not to say there aren't some access challenges, but I think it's both those things. It's access to health and all the things that support our health. I love the analogy of three little kids watching a baseball game, and the tallest one can see over the fence to look at the game. The shortest one needs a little bit of a box to see over, and the very shortest one needs two boxes to see over. And that's right. what we mean when we're talking about health equity. We're giving to people what they need to be healthy, not just giving everybody exactly the same thing. And right. It differs depending on where you are in this community.
That's Steve Buist is the, of course, the award-winning Spectator reporter whose Code Red is his project that you were referencing. Oftentimes when you're talking about these sorts of the big picture on that, that could be a sobering sort of thing. I mean, we're in some cases with families, and I've written about, you know, people who, you know, generation after generation are the kid on the short box, that doesn't change, and that becomes a big socioeconomic. Can that feel overwhelming to someone in public health when you're talking about the determinants of health, which are so fundamental and seemingly can't be overcome? I guess that you wouldn't take that position. But.
Well, I think it can feel overwhelming. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that was some of what Steve was raising was 10 years later. You know, what does it feel like to see that we haven't really come very far in terms of addressing it? And part of that's not unexpected because these are significant, you know, cultural issues. Mm-hmm. They're about the values we hold as a society, what we do, and what mechanisms we want to put in place. So they deserve and require great debate and take a while to figure out what's going to work and what isn't. But there are also things where we have a really good understanding, and so there is a lot of potential there, and we can make a difference, we can make some shifts. And so, you know, we have, as a department, for example, within Healthy and Safe Communities and at the City of Hamilton, we're talking about how we can better address health equity and have come together in a different way in order to address those things. So we're focusing on early childhood development, on mental health. How can we change some of the ways we do our own programs and services to better address that? And what can we do for our staff, our employees, when we think about it from that perspective? So there's a lot of good information about there about what can be done, and it's great to be in the middle of the debate to think about where it can go.
Right, well, so diagnosing the problem is part of the solution, right?
Absolutely.
Well, it's important work, critical work. And Elizabeth, Dr. Richardson, thank you for coming in to appear on The Message. Be well.
Thanks very much, Sean. Appreciate the chance to be here.
I hope you'll visit again. And thanks to Aisha Nasser and to the listeners. I'm John Wells, and we will talk to you later.